Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Last week, the Deepwater Horizon, an offshore oil rig drilling rig off Louisiana's coast, exploded and sank to the ocean floor. The disaster claimed 11 human lives and $500 million in oil investment. Now engineers are scrambling to plug an ocean floor wellhead a mile down, leaking 1,000 barrels of crude oil a day. A huge oil slick threatens the Gulf Coast. And all this just weeks after assurances of high-tech safety when President Obama announced his go-ahead for more offshore drilling. This hour on Point, offshore drilling disaster in the Gulf of Mexico. You can join the conversation. Have you seen the pictures of the burning rig, the huge and spreading oil slick? What's the lesson of the Deepwater Horizon disaster? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from Seattle is Doug Helton. He is Incident Operations Coordinator for the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration's Emergency Response Division. Before his current post, he was a longtime field responder for NOAA, who was at every major American oil spill in the last 15 years. He's now remotely managing a team in the Gulf, analyzing a constant flow of data and reports and images coming in. Doug Helton, thank you very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me on this today.
And with us from New Orleans is Aaron Viles, Campaign Director for the Gulf Restoration Network, which works to protect fisheries and habitats in the Gulf of Mexico. He's been following the oil leak closely as it threatens the environment of the Gulf Coast. Aaron Viles, thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
Doug Helton, give us the latest. You're watching all the data come in. What's going on right now? What's the status of the wellhead, the oil that's coming up from the seafloor, and it's spread in the Gulf of Mexico?
Well, oil is the rig is continuing to leak. The well is continuing to leak, and estimates of about 1,000 barrels a day. And there's a lot of work going on trying to figure out how to control that leak, including a number of efforts to use remote underwater vehicles and other technologies. My agency's role here is to help on the environmental side, on the forecasting, and on the fate and effects of the oil, but I am well aware of what's going on in terms of the control measures.
I'm seeing this described by industry sources in Houston as one of the worst oil rig disasters ever. I mean, this was one of the most modern and gigantic oil rig platforms in the world, insured for $500+ billion, and now it's gone down. Surely this was the kind of rig that people thought was impervious, a kind of Titanic.
Well, it is one of the largest incidents in the last couple decades. I was looking at some statistics this morning, and on average, there are small releases from offshore platforms around the country, and we've responded to others in recent years, but nothing on this magnitude, and certainly nothing this challenging from almost a mile below the surface.
So this rig remains, though now on the ocean floor, 40 or 50 miles off the coast of Louisiana, and its pipes extended down about a mile to the ocean floor. First of all, do we know yet why it exploded, you know, went into flame and went down? What about that explosion, Doug?
That's still being evaluated and investigated, and that's going to be a long-term process to investigate both the what happened with the well and what happened with the drilling ship. And so those are investigations being handled by the U.S. Coast Guard and the Minerals Management Service.
But at this point, we don't know. We know that it's on the ocean floor, that gigantic rig at this point. The oil is coming out of those long pipes that come from the wellhead to the rig, and you've described them as, well, it's about a mile of that pipe, and it's sort of twisted like a garden hose with some kinks in it, and the leakage is from those kinks in the hose, if I understand you correctly.
Yes, that's correct. It's pretty amazing to envision, but when the rig sank, the riser pipe, which is about a mile long, collapsed and buckled into a pile of tangled pipe on the seafloor. And these are 20-inch pipes, steel pipes, so it's not a particularly flexible pipe to begin with. Mm-hmm. There is some flexibility, but now it's bent over and kinked in multiple spots, and that's what's keeping the well from releasing more oil. The kinks are actually keeping just like a garden hose.
The oil in check, but it's also where it appears to be leaking from these remote subs that have gone down. That leaves the risk that the wellhead itself, which was supposed to automatically cap off and did not, could still go and release a much greater volume, I assume.
That's what all the response efforts are on right now, is to try to trigger that blowout preventer device. And I'm not a petroleum engineer. I work more on the environmental side. But this structure, this blowout preventer, is a device the size of a small house, really, sitting on the seafloor, and a very complicated structure, and over a mile deep. So it's pretty advanced technology to even be able to access this remotely and try to trigger it.
We're going to talk with a couple of engineers before we're finished here. Aaron Viles, you're watching all this. We're told about 1,800 square miles of oil sheen on the surface at this point. A lot of oil moving very deep in the Gulf of Mexico. I suppose there's environmental damage already, obviously, in the Gulf. And then there's the coast to worry about, which is your real focus.
Well, we're terrified about the impacts of this spill, both what's already happened, as far as we can tell, and what will happen when inevitably this spill comes ashore. And it's hard to forecast where exactly that's going to happen or when exactly, but rest assured, within the next 24 to 72 hours, we're going to start seeing some coastal impacts. But the marine impacts, I think, are going to be ultimately assessed as significant. It's hard to say right now, but they apparently, Fish and Wildlife or the State Wildlife and Fisheries Agency, saw sperm whales in the sheen, although they said, quote-unquote, they didn't seem to be impacted. Mm. But we know there's a resident population of sperm whales in the area that feed in the area, and it's not incredibly well-researched. Ironically enough, what we know about the sperm whales is probably because of the oil and gas exploration in the area. Mm-hmm. But it is something that, they're well-known, it's an endangered species, and the research indicates that, that subspecies can sustain no more than about 3 human-caused deaths a year without threatening its recovery. So we're very concerned about what the impacts are going to be.
And you've got a lot of other endangered species out there, turtles and bluefin tuna and snapper and grouper. There's only 2 sort of nurseries for bluefin tuna in the world, and the Gulf of Mexico is one of them. So you've got a big – and if it comes ashore, what's threatened there, Aaron?
Well, there's clearly an economic reality, because a lot of the seafood that people know and love from New Orleans comes from our marsh. The oysters, the shrimp, the crab. It's crab season now. We're about to start inshore shrimp season. The oyster reefs are very expansive and very hard to move out of the way when a sheen or spill comes ashore. So this is $1 billion a year in economic activity that's directly tied to that coastal ecosystem. So we're certainly concerned about the impact it's going to have both to the environment and to the economy. We're keeping our fingers crossed that the effects will be minimal, but we really want to see a scaled-up response as far as cleaning up the surface. It's such a large area, and I know it's very challenging, and I know they're working very hard underwater to try to use that blowout preventer valve, but the onshore, the surface-level impacts, it seems like they haven't done a heck of a lot to try to contain it.
And you're saying it's not if, but when it hits the shore. I'm looking here at environmentalists on Dauphin Island, where I've spent a lot of happy time over there next door to Louisiana, saying we've never seen anything like this magnitude of a spill coming toward them. Doug Helton, what about the surface and the subsurface containment efforts at this point? Can you really contain this much oil over that much space?
Well, first of all, the oil that's being released from depth is coming to the surface fairly rapidly. We estimate that it's surfacing in 2 to 3 hours. It takes that long for the oil to reach the surface. And then when it does, it forms a surface slick. There are efforts to try to skim it and collect it. There are also efforts to try to use chemical dispersants to disperse the oil. So there is a major, major response effort. There's essentially all the large skimming vessels in the Gulf of Mexico are out there working on this, and over 1,000 people working on this problem. But it is a very large problem. We're talking about slicks and sheens that extend over hundreds of square miles, thousands of square miles now, and it's very difficult once you release oil to try to contain it.
And the flow from that wellhead could get worse, and we're told, and we'll talk about the efforts going on down there to stop this, it could take days or could take weeks or could take months, we've heard, Doug Helton.
Well, the reports that British Petroleum BP has been giving at the Unified Command briefings is that it may take at least several months to drill a relief well. And so that is...
Which is sort of the worst case, biggest project for stopping this at months. And in the meantime, the oil flows.
Yes.
This is kind of staggering, Aaron. I mean, we were told just a few weeks ago that this just doesn't happen. You know, the new wave high-tech safety systems were such that offshore drilling had become a different species. It had become a different beast. We didn't have to worry about this.
Well, I think whoever was saying that was probably being paid to say it, and they weren't being paid to say it by the environment. They were being paid to say it by the oil industry. If you look at the track record, we have spills every day in the Gulf of Mexico. The Australian example from last year was a horrific example of an accident, cutting-edge technology, you know, and hard to contain, like we're going to see out of this one.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the massive offshore oil rig explosion in the Gulf of Mexico, the huge oil slick now spreading in the Gulf, and all the efforts underway to stop that oil coming out of the ocean floor, clean up, and prevent it getting to shore. But at this point, there's enough already out that may well be impossible. We've been joined from New Orleans by Aaron Viles. He's campaign director for the Gulf Restoration Network, watching the shoreline and its environment and the marine environment very closely right now. With us from Seattle is Doug Helton. He's incident operations coordinator for the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Association Emergency Response Division. He's watching all the data coming in from what's going on in the Gulf. I want to get the perspective of some oilmen who have worked a lot on rigs. Joining me in the studio today is Matteo Battista. He just finished 3 years as lead field engineer with Weatherford International, working on oil rigs mostly in the Gulf of Mexico. Matteo Battista, thanks very much for being here.
Thank you for having me, Tom.
And with us from Norman, Oklahoma, is Bruce Tate. He's instructor at the Mewburn School of Petroleum and Geological Engineering at the University of Oklahoma. He has spent 30 years in the drilling industries, worked in 18 countries on rigs onshore, offshore, and in deep water. Bruce Tate, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
First of all, how does a rig of this size go down, Bruce? You've worked on a lot of them. This is a very, very big one. No one knows exactly what set off the explosion, but just give us a physical sense. There was an explosion. Do you have any idea where on the rig, and what's the series of events that could, you know, lead to it? It's now upside down about a mile under.
The reports say that the incident happened at approximately 10 o'clock at night, and we know in the oil industry that we don't test wells at night. We understand that it was an exploration well, and to the depth that that progress had been made in the drilling activities is unknown.
Mm-hmm.
At least it hasn't been reported, but the fire could have happened due to a well control situation or also by the power or the electrical equipment that may have gotten involved. It's still being investigated.
Now, once a fire gets going, a rig of this size, that far out, 40, 50 miles out, and in a water a mile deep, presumably it's not doesn't have stationary anchor to the ocean floor. It's floating, I assume.
That's correct. This rig is a dynamically positioned semi-submersible, rated to drill a depth of 30,000 feet in a maximum water depth of 10,000 feet. It has 8 fixed propelled thrusters, which have a horsepower rating of 7,375 per thruster, and that's what helps it to keep its station.
I believe this was built somewhere in Asia, then brought across to the Gulf, bigger than a football field. What would take it down? There's a fire, but why would it lose its flotation?
Well, that remains to be determined. We know that the weather conditions were not like they were in the Katrina hurricane. We'll have to hear the formal report when it's issued as far as what actually happened. To do otherwise would be to speculate.
Mm-hmm.
It was built in South Korea in 2001, and it's been working in the Gulf of Mexico. This happened in the Mississippi Canyon Block 252, which is located, for your viewers' information, approximately 41 miles offshore southeast of the border of, Louisiana border.
Mateo Batista, you've worked on these rigs. We've all seen the pictures. They look so gigantic, they look kind of indestructible. And this one, bigger than a football field, insured for more than $500 million, that's a lot of equipment out there. You would think it couldn't go down. When you work on these rigs, do you have a sense I'm on something that could explode and sink to the bottom?
I mean, absolutely. From my experience, offshore safety is paramount. I mean, absolutely, they can run you off for, going outside without a hard hat on, because there's so much money involved. Everybody has such a big stake in these things that it's hard to imagine, because from day one, as soon as you enter the oil field, safety is
everybody's talking about it.
Absolutely.
And in spite of that, this one of the biggest ones in the world has gone down.
Right. And this is much bigger than anything that I've ever worked on personally.
Mm-hmm.
Most of the ones that I worked on were jackups in the Gulf.
What's a jackup?
Basically, it's fixed to the ocean floor on these three or four
pillars
stands.
To the floor.
Right, exactly, and they can maneuver the rig up and down on these stands.
How many, Bruce? Maybe on a smaller rig, how many men would be working, and what about on a bigger one? 11 missing, presumed dead on the Deepwater Horizon. What kind of crew would it have had, Bruce? A rig that size.
Well, the capacity of this rig is 130 persons. On a larger rig, there are some larger than this one, possibly a maximum of personnel of approximately 200. On jackup rigs, probably less, maybe 100 or so. I'd like to add a comment on the size of the rig. It was the length of the rig was 396 feet. The width was 256 feet. So it's a very large vessel. I would like to say that with your other participant that mm-hmm. BP and Transocean have acted very responsible in this incident.
It's Transocean built it and owns it, I guess, and BP has leased it for this exploration.
That is correct,
mm-hmm,
sir.
Mm-hmm.
The industry has a very strict compliance with Minerals Management Service safety regulations, and I applaud Transocean and BP, having been affiliated with both, in that the safety is always emphasized. And to compare it to the airline industry, right briefly, we have accidents. Accidents happen from time to time. But the overall safety emphasis by our industry is paramount. We're talking about well control. We're talking about survival offshore, helicopter training and mm-hmm. safety measures.
Mm-hmm.
And this incident, from the pictures I've seen of the sheen on there, is a very light oil. And I know by looking at the reports that BP has been very responsible and has acted prudently. And within one day, they had a flotilla of vessels to react to this incident.
We hear your applause for the safety, and I get it. But at the same time, that giant rig is on the ocean floor, and it's leaking, and it already has a marine impact, may hit the shore as well. I mean, the safety clearly didn't work out here.
Well, that's true. However, if you compare it to Valdez oil spill, this oil is a lot lighter crude, and everyone in the industry knows that going offshore for these people that died, unfortunately,
mm-hmm.
we know that there's risk involved, but our industry is very well trained, and I applaud our industry as a whole for they go beyond what would be expected in safety. They police themselves because they have families and they do not rejoice in any way over any safety violation or anything like that.
No, with this much at stake, lives and capital, I'm sure they don't. But Aaron Viles, what do you hear when you hear the applause for safety, but nevertheless you're watching the sheen, the slick spread?
Well, clearly BP doesn't want to spill. I think there's no profit incentive to spill oil. But their track record, I think, refutes what this gentleman is saying. They have a lot of accidents. The North Slope in 2006, a very significant spill, refinery accidents in Texas. This is a dirty, dangerous business. It's a human and environmental tragedy that we're looking at right now. It's only going to get worse. And I think to argue otherwise ignores reality. So no disrespect against your work and the efforts you've put in to provide energy for this nation. Clearly, we've demanded it. But I think this is...
I would like to cite an example, Exxon drilling horizontal in Santa Barbara. Mm-hmm. They just got through drilling the horizontal well offshore California, a very environmentally sensitive area with no problem whatsoever.
No one's saying that it happens every time. But I am certainly saying that if you look at the track record of the oil industry, I challenge you to ignore the spills that have happened. It's a dirty and dangerous business, and if we want to expand it in more and more of our coastal areas, we'll see more and more of these examples.
I want to bring our listeners in right here, if I may. Ike in Charleston, South Carolina. Ike, you're on the air.
Thanks for taking my call. Mm-hmm. I've been running around like John the Baptist trying to get people to open up and take a look at another accident that's happened in the shore off the shores of Australia in the Timor Sea. If you want to see what's going to happen with the wellhead that just blew out, they had a rig that did the same thing. It didn't sink, but it laid out over 500,000 barrels of oil. It took them 3.5 months to plug that well. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Look, this is like launching a space shuttle. This is like building a nuclear power plant. You folks can.
Oh, wait a minute!
Say
you said nuclear power plant. You said Chernobyl. Think about Chernobyl in Russia. They had an accident, and this is nowhere near the kind of death and aftermath of what happened at Chernobyl. Are we going to stop having nuclear power plants? When you talk about France, the entire country of France is nuclear powered, and of course
we did stop in this country for a long time. But Bruce, if you would, Ike, let me just get you to complete your point there. Where were you headed?
My point is whether you're launching a space shuttle or you're building a nuclear plant, you can say that you've got a perfect safety record. You know, it's like the guy that goes to the gas station and he's 70 years old and he's been smoking a cigarette every time he fills his gas tank up. Well, you know what? The one time when you got a problem, you're going to have a big problem. And I'm telling you, go over there and look at what happened to the Timor Sea. It's ongoing now. You've killed a lot of wildlife, and it's a big environmental damage. And you never have cleaned up what the mess was with the Valdez. So,
I appreciate your call, and we've got it. Bruce Tate, if I may ask you, there's the concern, you hear it. People are really, worried about what happens when it does go wrong. But what about that gigantic blowout preventer valve down there a mile deep at the wellhead? It's supposed to collapse onto the wellhead, I guess, or something like that, and stop this. 400 tons ought to do the trick, but it hasn't worked. Why not?
This is Cameron BOP equipment, from what I understand and what I've gathered. To know exactly what failed, I don't know, because it hasn't been published. So that is my response. We don't know the facts.
Mm-hmm.
We don't want to speculate. We want to know the facts of what failed. All rigs have subsurface safety valves that are implemented in the drilling design.
Mm-hmm.
Every caution is given. Accidents happen just like they do in the airline industry. We cannot live without power in the United States from the petroleum industry.
We've heard your point on that front, but I'm trying to figure out how to get it stopped at this point. Now,
at this point in time, they've mobilized two vessels to drill relief wells, which is a common standard practice in drilling circles in case of blowouts, like it happened for Egypt or Eni in north of Egypt.
They would drill down alongside the original well and try and divert the oil and capture it so it doesn't go into the ocean. Doug Helton, there's also discussion, and that's a long-term project, there's also discussion of putting a gigantic dome over this whole ocean floor leak and try and stop it that way, but that's never been done in water this deep, Doug.
Right. My understanding, and I'm familiar with the technology, that basically it's a large tent-like structure that can be lowered over a leaking pipeline or some other leak on the seafloor and use the fact that oil floats to collect that oil in the top of the dome and then pipe that to the surface. And after, my understanding is after Hurricane Katrina, there was a number of leaks in pipelines and rigs that were controlled in this manner until they could be completely controlled.
But how long might that take?
BP is designing and engineering this structure, but I'm not. They haven't provided any timeline for when that might be put into the seafloor.
Let me get a call from Iowa, Sheridan, Iowa. George, you're on the air, George.
Yeah, hi, Tom. Yeah, hi. I was wondering what the politicians like Sarah Palin and John McCain are saying, that whose motto was drill, baby, drill, or Barack Obama, who's been selling more oil leases offshore. I mean, what are they saying about this, and why aren't they being held responsible for this kind of damage?
Well, we'll look at it. The White House Press Secretary Robert Gibbs' spokesman was asked about this, Robert Gibbs, a couple days ago, whether the president had second thoughts on offshore drilling, and he simply said no. Aaron Viles, the country uses a lot of oil. It demands a lot of energy. What do you think about the question of more offshore drilling, given what we're seeing right now in the Gulf off your shore?
I think, again, this just kind of underscores the big lie that's out there about oil. And there's clearly defenders of the industry. They're on this call with me. But the reality of it is it takes a very long time to develop offshore sites. So if we're serious about, you know, our short-term energy needs and trying to answer them with offshore oil, it just doesn't make a lot of sense. It takes, 10-plus years to develop an offshore field. So as we expand our footprint in our coastal area, where should we be spending that 10 years? I would argue we should be moving forward with solar and wind, because no one's scared about a sun spill or a wind spill.
Mateo Batista, when you're out on the rigs working, are you thinking, I'm keeping the lights on for the country? Are you thinking we need more of this? Are you thinking we need more wind and sun instead?
I mean, I don't think the answer is one or the other. It certainly has to be they both need to be developed. I think drilling offshore on the East Coast is a good idea. It's just going to provide us with a surplus of energy while we further develop those solar and alternative energies. I mean, I've been on both sides. I've worked for fuel cell companies,
mm-hmm.
And I've worked in the oil industry. So I think you have to have both of those as part of the answer.
Bruce Tate, you can imagine, though, we heard a lot of talk a couple of weeks ago when the president announced more area open for offshore drilling, about how far safety had come, and you cite it yourself, and of course everybody appreciates that. But now here's the counterexample. You can imagine those assurances of safety are going to fall sort of flat looking forward here, Mr. Tate.
Yes, sir. Tom, I want to point out that the United States is in a financial situation that the government is considering to cut spending and also to increase taxes.
Mm-hmm.
I want to bring this point to the table, that by I believe that the president acted responsibly in advocating an integrated approach to increase drilling and development of alternative energy sources, with the idea of the offshore leases and the revenue that would bring into the United States government. Taxpayers need to consider that offshore companies operating in the Gulf of Mexico and on the eastern coast of Atlanta will pay significant amounts to lease these leases to do exploration, and it is in the vital economic interest of the United States, undoubtedly, to do what the president advocated in allowing offshore drilling to take place in the eastern part of the Gulf of Mexico once they've determined the seismic activity on the west coast of Florida.
A lot to look at there. Bruce Tate, I know we have to let you go. In Norman, Oklahoma today, joining us from the Mewburn School of Petroleum and Geological Engineering at the University of Oklahoma. Bruce Tate, thanks for being here.
Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the massive offshore oil rig explosion in the Gulf of Mexico and the huge oil slick now spreading in the Gulf on the surface and a mile down, where it's much more difficult to control, even to see where it's headed. Doug Helton is with us. He's Incident Operations Coordinator for the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Association's Emergency Response Division. He's been all over oil spills for a long time. Matteo Battista is with us. He just finished 3 years as lead field engineer with the Weatherford International, working on oil rigs in the Gulf of Mexico. Knows that scene intimately from his work there. And Aaron Viles, environmentalist, is with us from New Orleans, watching that oil sheen, oil slick, as it threatens the shore and already the marine life in the Gulf of Mexico. Mike in Holden, Massachusetts. Mike, you're on the air.
Hi. I got a question and a point I'd like to make to your caller that went on commending the industry. He seems to fail to absorb the reality of the situation and the cost of which we have yet to know.
Yep.
I have a couple questions. Is one, as far as the ongoing cleanup, regardless of the future, who's going to pay for that? And two, why doesn't the industry or why doesn't the government have the industry have a backup plan for these potential failures? There's at least three things that went wrong. An explosion and fire, which is one, then the sinking, and then the failure to cap, which you would think would be a fail-safe type of mechanism.
You would hope so. You would hope so. But let us pick those up. And, Mike, thank you for your call.
I can help with that issue of who pays.
Is that Doug?
Yes.
Yes.
After the Exxon Valdez, the U.S. passed the Oil Pollution Act of 1990, and that codified all the requirements for how oil spills responded to, and one of the principal tenets is that the polluter pays. There is a very strong liability scheme, and the BP has taken responsibility and will continue to pay for the cleanup, and they've already put out claims numbers.
But what all do they pay for, Doug? I mean, you're working on this. You got the Coast Guard down there with Rear Admiral Mary Landry, commander of the 8th Coast Guard Division District, and all of her people working on this. Will BP pay for your time on this and the Coast Guard's?
Yes, there's a whole range of costs that the spiller is responsible for, including the government costs for monitoring and directing the response. There's categories for claims for fishermen.
And what about the fail-safe question that our caller raises? Is such a thing possible? And if so, why not?
I think that, unfortunately, the blowout preventer is the fail-safe system, and that failed as well. So the caller is correct that there was a cascading series of events, and the one thing that was supposed to happen if everything else failed was the blowout preventer, and they're still trying to activate that and can't understand or determine why it didn't activate in the first place.
Matteo, what's your thoughts about this? 400 tons is down there. It's supposed to drop onto the wellhead at the seafloor and stop it. I mean, we just don't know now, but how could it not happen?
Speaking to Mike's comments about fail-safes, there are usually lots in place. You know, there are alarms to signify whether a rig's taking a kick and should be preparing for a blowout.
What does taking a kick mean, Matteo?
Basically, what happens is an infusion of gas will come into the...
sort of burp up from underground.
Right, exactly. Mm-hmm. The well is drilled with what they call mud, which basically allows the pressure from entering into the well bore. So if you get an infusion of gas, typically they'll...
Kind of surges up through those pipes up through the well
exactly.
head.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and as that gas rises, it expands. And if it gets to the surface, that's how you have a blowout and an explosion.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, there's alarms in place to see whether that happens, and then the BOP and several other things. So, I mean, for this to happen, there has to be kind of a conflux, a perfect storm of events, if you will. And like Bruce was saying, you know, to say exactly what happened would kind of be speculation at this point.
But Doug, is such a thing as fail-safe possible? I mean, it was just a couple of weeks ago when the president was announcing his new policy that the suggestion was sort of out there that we essentially lived in a fail-safe era. Now, our caller, Ike, looking down to East Timor and Australia, I'm sure was saying, well, no, we don't. But now we're just looking to the Gulf, and it's obvious that we don't.
I think that the answer to that is that the industry is a lot safer than it was 30 years ago, but there's still a risk. Anytime you're moving, transporting, drilling oil, there's still a risk of a spillage, and that's where we are now, is trying to address the aftermath of
of that, trying to contain it, clean it up, and minimize the impacts. But at this point, you know, there's no good answer. It's just trying to minimize the adverse effects that we know are going
to
happen.
Let's go to Boone, North Carolina, and Anne. Hi, Anne. You're on the air.
Hi. Just a little information on BP. In 2005, there were 15 refinery workers killed in Texas. They were fined BP was fined $87 million.
At a big refinery plant there. Yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm. This is all BP. And in Ohio, they were fined $3 million for safety violations. I don't know what the year was. And in 2006, they had a pipeline spill in Alaska. So, you know, their track record is pretty dismal, in my opinion.
But maybe it's the business itself. I mean, maybe that just comes with pulling oil out of the ground. Sometimes it's going to spill. I don't say that to excuse it, but maybe it just comes with the, you know, with this form of energy.
But we're led to believe that it's also safe, you
right.
know.
And, yeah.
And that I think they're very deceitful in what they release to the public.
It's true. It's not long ago that 15 dead in Texas and a very big fine, and here we are again with BP. That's quite true. Thanks, Anne. Let me go to Dave in New Haven, Connecticut. Dave, you're on.
Hi. I just want to point out that part of the Obama expansion of oil drilling offshore was in the Beaufort Sea and other parts of the
north of Alaska,
Arctic Ocean. Mm-hmm. Yes. And, you know, they're talking about more and more drilling there. The oil companies, including BP, are looking at plans for deep-sea drilling there as the ice clears out more and more in the summer. But what they don't talk about is if there were a similar explosion like this and you couldn't clean it up for a month or two and it happened near the end of the summer, you're talking about the ice coming back over the oil spill for the winter and the oil continuing to flow up under the ice with no ability to stop it, and the damage to that would cause is incalculable.
I hadn't thought of it. Let us pick it up. Doug, have you looked at that? Are there different degrees of offshore drilling danger?
I think that you know, the industry is a lot safer, but what we're seeing is we're drilling in more and more remote locations. And so while there are safeguards in place, I think you also have to look at some of the challenges in some very remote areas, and the Arctic is one of them. And even with, you know, receding ice cover, we're still going to have a very rugged environment and very remote. If you think about this response, we're only 50 miles from shore and from the heart of the oil industry with all of the support vessels and ROV technologies. There isn't a release that could happen up in a remote area of Alaska would be logistically much more challenging to get equipment and personnel on scene to do the activities we see on scene right now.
Let's go to Alaska. We've got a caller from Juneau, Alaska. Steve, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Hey, I just wanted to make two or three quick points. I was in Valdez for the first 58 days of the Valdez spill, and it always seems like it's a confluence of screw-ups. It's always a perfect storm of something that just got out ahead of us and we never quite caught up to it. Second point is, boy, try as we did, we could not put all that toothpaste back in the tube. I think people better start looking at the long-term effects of this stuff being held in the water column or on the bottom of the ocean. And third, it's a cost of doing business. Look at Exxon. They've never paid off any of the people in Valdez. I'll take all the comments off the air. Thanks a lot.
Cautionary tale from an Alaskan caller right there. And Steve, I appreciate that. I mean, you're close to where the Valdez was. One more right here. Newark, Vermont. Nancy, you're on the air, Nancy.
Hello. Just a very quick comment on an impact for all this that isn't mentioned too often, and perhaps by comparison to the real tangible effects seems a little almost silly, but I'm almost 80 and have had decades of loving this planet and all the species on it, and over the decades have seen what our species is doing to that planet and other species. And I know there are lots and lots of natural disasters, but this morning, as I listened to your show and heard how the tangible impact is coming, I felt there's an emotional thing for so many of us that sometimes I'm sure is felt but not always mentioned. I grieve as I hear this. And it came to light as I was trying to think or say a little prayer or whatever, saying, you know, forgive us for what we're doing to this planet. And all of a sudden, it was almost like a, not only of my own volition, it was like, maybe it's time to stop forgiving us. We're doing such irreparable harm.
Nancy, cumulatively, I know what you mean. It's a very large toll. You can look at it in dollars and cents and keeping the lights on. Then you look around and look at it in terms of the damage that can ensue, and it can be a lot to bear. And I appreciate your pointing that out. Thank you very much for your call. Mateo, you going back out on a big rig soon?
Well, I'm going to be starting up in June.
Offshore or on?
I think initially it will be onshore.
So off the water for a little while.
Right.
Maybe you're just as happy having watched this thing go down not to be on another one next week.
Absolutely. You tend to get a little antsy offshore when you're staying out there for a couple of months, you know.
Yeah.
It can become a very small place. But just to speak to some of the callers that were on, I mean, I don't think anyone is saying that you're never going to have accidents. I think in any endeavor, especially one that relies on such high-tech equipment and such a difficult work environment, you're always going to have the potential for issues. But if you allow yourself to be paralyzed by worst-case scenarios, then it's going to be really hard to accomplish anything. You know, it's important to acknowledge what can happen and then take that on as a challenge and say, well, you know, this is the worst-case scenario. What can we do? What kind of fail-safes can we put in place and mechanisms by which we can, you know, stop that? Nothing's perfect, but you have to do everything you can.
I guess what we're learning here is even the fail-safes are not perfect, are not
absolutely
fail-safes. Mateo Batista, we appreciate your perspective from the rig, and thanks very much for being here today.
Thank you so much. Kristen sends her love, by the way.
Thanks, then, and best to her. Aaron Viles, what are you watching as we wrap up here? You know, when and where? What's your best and worst-case scenario now?
I guess the worst-case scenario is that we see a repeat of the Timor Sea incident that took months to get those relief wells drilled and shut down the source, and that we're going to see major coastal fouling and significant impacts on our sea turtles, our amazing marine wildlife that use that area. Again, we're terrified about this, and I think anyone on any coastal area where they're proposing drilling right now, you need to go into that decision-making process with your eyes wide open, knowing that this can come to your coast. And it's not really a matter of if, it's a matter of when, if we continue to drill on into the future.
Well, eyes are wide open today, and you've helped make them. So Aaron Viles with the Gulf Restoration Network in New Orleans, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
And Doug Helton at the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Association Emergency Response Division with us today from Seattle. Doug, thank you very much to you. Thanks to all of you for being with us.
Thanks, Tom.
I want to turn right now to Washington and our old friend Juliet Eilper, national environmental reporter for The Washington Post. She's been watching not only what's going on in the Gulf, but the big hoopla over the climate bill that was supposed to be rolled out in Washington this week. Juliet, thank you very much for joining us.
Great to be here, Tom.
So first, just to this toppling of this gigantic rig in the Gulf of Mexico, I mean, if this had happened 6 weeks ago, do you think President Obama would still be rolling out more offshore drilling?
I think it would give him some reason for pause, and it already has given some lawmakers reason for pause as they're working on this climate bill that we'll discuss. And so it's certainly something that makes politicians think, wait a minute, maybe we can't endorse this as aggressively as we have.
Tell us about the climate bill and where it stands now. You had this troika of senators. John Kerry of Massachusetts, Joe Lieberman of Connecticut, and, of course, Senator Graham of South Carolina. It fell apart. Why and where's the bill stand?
Well, it's in limbo is the best term to use at this point, I think. But basically what happened over the weekend is that, again, you have this climate troika, and one of the key players is Senator Lindsey Graham, the Republican from South Carolina. He's really the one person who both has been a bridge to the business community as they've been trying to draft a compromise that can attract 60 votes, and also is a key bridge to Republicans in terms of getting their support, which they'll need since there'll be a certain number of Democrats who won't support this. Lindsey Graham, who happens to be one of the only Republicans in Washington collaborating with Democrats, decided on Saturday that he would no longer participate in helping on climate because he's so angry at Senate Majority leader Harry Reid for raising the prospect of bringing up immigration reform legislation. And that threatened to torpedo the entire process. We now have Senator Graham back talking with Senators Kerry and Lieberman about whether there's a way forward, but it's still unclear how they're going to resolve this impasse, that there's some political reasons why Democrats would want to push immigration reform, but Graham, who had been working on this issue, considers this a betrayal. He called it breaching faith because he feels like it's a politically difficult issue that has no chance for passage and would undermine efforts to get a bipartisan consensus on energy and climate legislation.
And this walking away from maybe a bill that was already in itself considered quite a... there were a lot of compromises in this bill.
There were a lot of compromises. They had made concessions on everything from, you know, offshore oil drilling, sharing revenues with states, blocking the EPA's and states' ability to regulate greenhouse gases under the Clean Air Act. So they had made a lot of concessions in order to win over the backing of some of these oil companies, including BP, in fact, as well as electric utilities. And so, you know, in many ways, you know, you did have people who were willing to make a deal, but there was also some environmentalists were saying, you know, saying, is this the price that we're going to have to pay in order to put a price on carbon?
So is Senator Reid saying he would hold off on immigration to let the climate bill move ahead? Or is
he has
that...
not. Interestingly, he has not made that commitment yet. His office and he keeps saying, look, you know, we're going to go with what's ready, and we would anticipate that climate and energy would be ready before immigration. There's it's certainly much farther along in the legislative process. But what's interesting is he has not been willing to give a firm commitment to Lindsey Graham that would allow him to fully engage in this process. And the question is, does the White House broker a deal on this? Is there a way that Senators Kerry and Lieberman can convince Reid to give the kind of assurances that Senator Graham needs? But it certainly will take more from Senator Reid, who is fighting to save his own job this fall.
Right. So stalemate on climate as the rig leaks in the Gulf. Juliet Alpern with The Washington Post, thanks so much for being here. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.